you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.
All right, well, attempt number 2 or 3 at this point for Politics and Science, and my special guest today is Dr. Gordon Edwards. He's on the faculty at Vanier College, where he's been a teacher for a long time. And Gordon Edwards graduated from the University of Toronto with a gold medal in mathematics and physics. In 1961, he earned a master's degree in mathematics and English at the University of Chicago under a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. After teaching at the University of Western Ontario for 4 years, he obtained a PhD in math from Queen's University in 1972. He became the editor of Survival, an environmental newsletter with subscribers in 13 countries. In 1973, he coordinated a 7-volume study of the role of mathematics in Canadian business, government, and science for the Science Council of Canada. In 1974, he joined the faculty of Vanier College, where he's been a teacher ever since. In 1975, he co-founded the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, CCNR. You can find their website at ccnr.org, and rose to prominence as one of Canada's best-known independent experts on nuclear technology, uranium, and proliferation. And that's what we'll be talking about today. Welcome to Politics and Science, Professor Edwards.
Hi there, John Barkhausen. How are you?
I'm all right. We finally got the bugs worked out here. I'd like to talk to you about, I know you have a lot to tell us about nuclear technology, but first, how did you get involved in being interested in it? Your background was in math.
Yes, that's right. My background was in mathematics, and, well, it was in science and mathematics. And I graduated in applied mathematics from the University of Toronto, which is really theoretical physics. And only the later did I go into pure mathematics. My interest was spurred by weapons of mass destruction, particularly the nuclear arsenals that we've amassed on the planet, which are quite capable, even today, of eliminating civilization in a very short period of time. Many people don't know that the U.S. has upwards of 5,000 nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. They could be fired within a very short period of time, and that the result of such a nuclear exchange with any other country would be catastrophic. So the real thing that got me involved was the realization that the most dangerous people on the planet for the last 100 years have actually been the scientists, who have been making available these powerful forces and putting them at the disposal of heads of government and heads of corporations, and thereby imperiling the very future of the human race and even the future of life on Earth. So although it sounds melodramatic, it's in fact the reality we find ourselves in. And in 1970, I attended a talk given by one of the most famous mathematicians of all time, Alexander Grothendieck, who is regarded as undoubtedly the most brilliant mathematician of the 20th century. And he made a passionate appeal at a mathematical conference in Montreal here for scientists around the world to wake up to their social responsibilities and to stop opting out of civilization, as he put it, and begin to realize that if we scientists do not share our knowledge with other people in a non-elitist way, but rather in a sense of comradeship and the fact that we're all in this problem together, then how can we expect ordinary people to deal with the problem and take it seriously? So he was making a passionate appeal for scientists to become politically involved in the least partisan sense of that word. To become a part of the political conscience of the age, and to speak up and make it clear to everybody that we're headed for annihilation if we don't change our ways drastically.
I think that's in part why I named the show Politics and Science, because I think many people think that science is actually removed from our culture in a way. It's some kind of objective mechanism that has nothing to do with the lives we're all living.
Yes, and unfortunately, that's a dangerous illusion which even scientists labor under. Many mathematicians in particular, they believe that their mathematical work has absolutely nothing to do with the military or with threats to civilization or any of those things. But all you have to do is look at the funding that has gone into certain areas. All you have to do is look at the fact that so many scientists are employed in fabricating or maintaining weapons of mass destruction or military systems of other sorts that tend in that direction, or are working for corporations which are seriously damaging the world's environment. So when you look at it from an objective point of view, you can see very clearly that science is playing a key role, a leading role, in terms of fostering the types of behavior, or at least, let's say, giving the wherewithal for these types of behaviors, which are, in fact, threatening the planet. So for scientists themselves to think that their search for knowledge is simply a pure search for knowledge unrelated to what's going on in the world is a very dangerous delusion.
Because there are people out there using that knowledge for the advancement of their own agendas, some of which are not that pretty.
Absolutely. And for scientists to basically say, well, that's not my business, is really an abdication of responsibility. It's basically washing our hands, you might say, and saying, well, whatever happens is not my responsibility, even though I'm directly involved, my work is directly involved.
So you heard that speech and that's what inspired you, or did you become aware of the danger of nuclear technology?
Well, I was well aware of the dangers of nuclear technology. I think you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to realize the dangers. But like most people and like most scientists, I didn't make the connection with myself personally. I didn't think it was something that either involved me personally or that it was anything that I personally could do anything about. And so, again, Grothendieck's talk was quite a wake-up call for me, because he really addressed the question of what stops people from becoming active in the face of such a crisis. And he said that they are the stupidest things. For example, one of the reasons people don't become involved in this issue is because they say, well, anything I do will be ineffective. But his point was, well, what could be more ineffective than doing nothing? What could possibly be more ineffective than doing nothing? So, you know, to say that what I might do, is going to be ineffective is prejudging the issue. The scientific method says that if you want to find out something, you have to do an experiment. So his point was, why not try? Try and see if you can make a difference, and then you can have some data to work on. But if you don't try, you're simply psychologically lying to yourself.
Do you think it has something to do with the fact that speaking up, making waves against the establishment might actually threaten your financial position and your status?
Well, yes, absolutely so. But on the other hand, you look around the world, you look at the people who fought apartheid in South Africa, you look at the people in Poland who protested against the Soviet Empire, you look at the people, the women in Argentina who protested in the face of the generals about their disappeared sons and daughters who had been murdered by the thousands. People have shown courage all over the planet. Why not scientists?
So your work took you, you were a mathematician, and you became aware of not only the danger of nuclear weapons. Is that you, that was your first?
That was my first concern, although it very quickly, we founded a movement which did not actually have a very long lifespan, but nevertheless it was a call to action. It was a movement called Survival, and I became the editor of the newsletter of that movement called the Survival Newsletter. And what it was doing was addressing all of the real threats to the survival of humanity, to the survival of the planet. all of which are related to science and technology, the most prominent of which is nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction, because they can act so quickly and irreversibly. But also, from the very beginning, we addressed, even back in 1970, we addressed questions of global warming, we addressed questions of depletion of resources, overpopulation, food problems, you know, hunger and so on. All of these interrelated problems, which cumulatively can have an enormous destructive effect on the planet, the poisoning of the oceans, the simplification of ecosystems, the elimination of species through extinction, being driven to extinction, you know. All of these problems are really interrelated. They're all connected with science and technology in one way or another, because it's only through science and technology that mankind has obtained the ability to be so destructive. We couldn't overfish the oceans if we didn't have technology that allows us to scoop up every living thing and just turn it into a kind of a desert. So science and technology is intimately involved in all these things, and we feel that the whole planet really is facing what you might call an evolutionary crisis. It's a crisis of values which affects the entire planet physically. So that if you look at evolution as a 4-billion-year history or 5-billion-year history of the evolution of life on Earth, it's only relatively recently that any species has developed to the point where it can be a threat to the planet, and that's us. So if we don't adapt, if we don't figure out a way of adapting our behavior and our procedures, our science and technology, in more constructive directions, then we are going to be the authors of our own destruction.
Hmm.
And not only the authors of our own destruction, but what makes matters worse is that this could be a tremendous setback for evolution of life in general.
In that we would take down a large part of the world with us.
Exactly, exactly. Now, obviously, life would regenerate in some form, but why? Why would you want to undo 4 billion years of evolution?
Hmm. Yeah, it's a very slow and a beautiful process, but
absolutely. I mean, this is the whole thing: is that with the decline of traditional religions, which were more limited in their viewpoint in some regards, you know, in terms of religious intolerance and so on. But what we need is we need to have a kind of a spiritual appreciation of life itself. Not exactly a religion, but you might say something approaching a religious attitude towards the beauty of this planet, and to make an unscientific word, the miracle of life in this world. It's such an amazing planet, teeming with life. We've seen the other planets and how dead they are, and we should be thankful that we've got this great planet, and we should certainly not be working to undo it. So it's not that people are consciously sitting around and planning to ruin the planet. It's just that people have not elevated their views out of the particular framework they're in to really say, and this is what Grothendieck was really getting at, to really say that this affects me personally. And this not only affects me personally, but if I can't do something about this, then who can?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that you don't have to be a great person, you don't have to be a powerful person, because we all have an effect on the people around us, and whether you're an important, well-known scientist, or whether you're just an ordinary person doing their job, the point is that we all have friends and neighbors, we all have interactions with other people, we can all make a difference, and if we did this, if more people did this, then those differences would become manifested much better.
I think part of the big problem is that people just have no idea that we're in such dire straits.
Well, that's where the scientists can be helpful, you see. If the scientists sort of stop, take time out from earning their money and their accolades, and take time out from celebrating the glories of science, which we do endlessly, and which, of course, there's a lot to be celebrated in accomplishments of science. But what Alexander Grothendieck said is that, look, we've licked a lot of the major problems already, in principle. What we need to do now is stop, instead of just mass-producing more scientific results and just putting them out into the world to do whatever they might want to do, we should be spending more of our energy in trying to make the world compatible and sustainable using the science and technology that we've already developed.
Mm.
And from that point on, if we can sort of reach a sustainable society, then we can proceed with the advance of science in a more healthy environment, you might say. But at the present time, this pell-mell race towards greater accolades, greater glory, greater profits, and greater power militarily and politically is not leading us to a sustainable planet.
And then the other problem with raising people's awareness is the media.
Well, yes, but I think that on the other hand, some of the examples I gave earlier,
mm-hmm.
in Poland, in South Africa, in South America, it's kind of an ironic thing that many places where there is no free speech or where there has not been free speech in the past, they have managed to do this. Yeah, they've managed to organize themselves. They've managed to get the word out there and get it spread around. And we don't have to put ourselves at the mercy of the media. We just have to say, look, if the media are not doing their job, then we've got to do it instead. Because we've got the internet, we've got all kinds of just even personal communication. People underestimate the importance of just person-to-person communication.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know it sounds inefficient, but in fact, it's one of the most efficient things there is. Nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come.
That's true.
And these look at the environmental movement. The environmental movement as a whole has had pitiful resources, and yet they have made great strides simply because the ideas are so powerful and so pertinent and so irresistible that how can you possibly ignore them forever? So I think that that people use these drawbacks, such as the lack of political power, the lack of a cooperative media, or the lack of, let's say, adequate knowledge about what all the solutions might look like. They really use these as excuses to do nothing. And nothing can be more ineffective than doing nothing.
Well said. Well, let's talk a little bit about the nuclear technology itself, which I think you probably agree is one of the greatest threats to survival on our planet.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. And people do talk about global warming, and it is a serious problem, and it's a very good thing that people are waking up to that. But really, global warming is not really the number one threat, although it's up there. The spread of nuclear weapons is probably the number one threat to the planet because it can happen so quickly.
I think people have forgotten that the threat even exists.
Well, they better not forget it, because it's still there, and unfortunately we've fallen into this dangerous, comfortable hypocrisy, whereby we can scold countries like Iran and North Korea for developing nuclear weapons, and indeed it is frightening to see the spread of these weapons. But on the other hand, we have to realize that who are the people who have the most nuclear weapons, you know? The USA, France, Britain, China, Russia. And even some of our allies that the United States is working with and that Canada is cooperating with, India. By the way, India's first atomic bomb actually came from a Canadian nuclear reactor that we gave them as a gift. So, I mean, why do we turn a blind eye to these weapons when they are being held in trust by our friends, and then make out as if it's a crime against humanity for anybody else to even contemplate constructing these weapons? The hypocrisy is so thick you could cut it with a butter knife.
Can you explain, Professor Gordon Edwards, how Canada fits into the nuclear technology picture?
Well, Canada has, in fact, played a surprisingly important role, considering its relatively small size, and also considering the fact that it does not have a nuclear weapons program. Nevertheless, the way we got involved in the first place in Canada was the fact that we had the only available supply of uranium at that time for building the world's first atomic bombs. So that when Britain and France decided to proceed with an atomic bomb, they had to have Canada on board as a partner. And in 1942, there was a meeting in Quebec City, and President Roosevelt was there, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Prime Minister Mackenzie King of Canada, and they signed an agreement called the Quebec Agreement. And this agreement was that the three countries would cooperate to build the world's first atomic bombs, that they promised not to use the bombs against each other, and they also promised not to use it against any third party without unanimous consent. And Canada's role in this was twofold. One was to supply uranium, and the other, and to refine any other uranium that they came across, which they did. They found a whole lot of uranium coming from the Belgian Congo that was stored in a warehouse in Long Island, but that uranium was largely processed in Canada. It was refined at Port Hope, Ontario, because that was the only refinery that was currently available for doing this job. At the same time, there was a secret laboratory set up in Montreal on the slopes of Mount Royal near the University de Montréal, and at that secret laboratory, scientists from Britain, from France, and from other parts of Europe cooperated with Canadian scientists as junior partners in exploring the most efficient ways of producing and using plutonium for weapons. So that's how Canada got involved. We got involved through the World War II bomb project. And after the war, although we decided not to ourselves produce nuclear weapons in Canada, we still remained the world's largest supplier of uranium and the exporter of uranium, and we still are to this day. And up until 1965 or even 1970, all of the uranium that we exported from Canada was going directly into the bomb program. They were under military contracts, because that was the only market there was for uranium in those days. And in 1959, for example, Canada was the fourth most important export from Canada. Uranium was the fourth most important export from Canada in economic terms, after pulp and paper, timber, and wheat came uranium, and it was all for bombs. Now, at that same time, the Chalk River nuclear reactors were built, and many people don't know that the decision to build those reactors was made in Washington, D.C. in 1944, and it was a military decision. And it was part of the bomb program. The idea was to build heavy water reactors because those were the most efficient reactors at producing plutonium. And when the you've heard a lot in the news these days about the NRU reactor. That's the reactor, that old reactor that was producing the medical isotopes. Well, that reactor, when they built it in Canada at Chalk River back in 1957, they actually paid for some of the cost of building it by selling the plutonium to the American bomb program. So then when we turned around and gave a copy of the NRX reactor, that was a previous reactor, to India, India had used that reactor for the very same for one of the very same purposes we used it for, and that was to produce plutonium for bombs. So, and then we act all horrified when India actually does it. You know, now when India exploded its first atomic bomb in 1974, the whole world was shocked and outraged. But in that same week when India exploded that bomb, there were seven other far more powerful test explosions going on in the United States and Russia. And there was virtually not any single comment about those. So once again, this hypocrisy has been fundamental to the nuclear, to the spread of nuclear weapons. People cannot be, you can't run the world on a double standard. You can't expect that that you can you can't expect other countries to accept the logic that it's okay for us good guys, to have nuclear weapons, but it's not okay for regimes that we disapprove of, or that we consider to be unstable. As a matter of fact, you know, there's no reason to believe in the stability of any regime in any country in the world over the very long periods of time that we're talking about. I mean, you know, before Hitler came to power, we had a relatively peaceful Weimar Republic in Germany. We probably would have sold them a reactor in the Weimar Republic because they're a democracy, they're peaceful. But then Hitler comes to power. Well, you know, these things happen, even in a highly civilized country like Germany.
So reactors were primarily built initially to make the fuel for bombs. Is that correct?
That's all they were built for originally. The first reactors that were built were plutonium production reactors.
And their
job was really to mass produce plutonium for bombs. Now, somewhere along the line, and fairly early on, people got the idea, well, you know, when you produce the plutonium, and by the way, plutonium is actually created from uranium. So it's one of the many transmutations that uranium undergoes. I describe uranium as a shape-shifting element because it has hundreds of different shapes that it assumes, and one of those shapes is plutonium. when you put uranium fuel into a nuclear reactor in order to get a nuclear reaction occurring, some of that uranium is fissioned and split. The atoms are split to produce the energy that drives the reaction. But some of those atoms are also converted into plutonium atoms, and that's where plutonium comes from. So plutonium is a totally man-made substance. And the production of plutonium was the main purpose of these reactors. However, in the process of producing plutonium, you also produce enormous quantities of heat. And so somebody, of course, got the idea, well, couldn't we make use of that waste heat? And of course you can. You can use it to boil water. And if you use that waste heat to boil water, then you get steam, and if you run that steam through a turbine, you can generate electricity. So the electricity is really just a, you might say, a temporary byproduct of the production of plutonium.
I see. For the production of bombs.
Well, originally it was for the production of bombs. Now, recently, the nuclear industry worldwide, after having a very poor track record in terms of building new reactors, you know, in North America there hasn't been a new reactor really built, hasn't been ordered to be built for 30 years until the last couple of years. So there's been a long drought in sales. But nowadays what the nuclear industry is saying is that we want to have a nuclear renaissance. And the idea of the nuclear renaissance, the key idea is that we will recycle the used fuel. The people are now talking about recycling the used fuel. This is an extremely deceptive phrase because recycling the used fuel means extracting the plutonium for use as further fuel for nuclear reactors. The problem with doing that is that if you create a market in plutonium as fuel for reactors, then undoubtedly this is going to fall into the hands of criminals. You know, what is it that is there anything that is traded commercially that doesn't fall into the hands of criminals? Cash, diamonds, heroin, you name it. Mm. You know, anything that is traded will fall into the hands of criminals. Once plutonium falls into the hands of criminals, you have the potential for any criminal organization or terrorist group to build its own atomic bombs. Crude though they may be, they're sufficient to destroy an entire city.
Mm.
So this idea of creating a nuclear renaissance by recycling plutonium is one of the most threatening ideas in human history.
So, Professor Gordon Edwards, let me get this straight. I'm a little slow. You're saying that the original nuclear power plants were basically running on uranium, not plutonium?
And that our current nuclear reactors are also running on uranium. Perhaps I should back up and just explain a little bit about how this happens. It's a little complicated, but it's not that difficult to understand if people are patient to just listen to what we know about uranium. Uranium is a naturally occurring substance. It's all over the planet, really, but it's only in certain places where it's concentrated enough to make it economically viable for mining it to extract it from the earth. Now, it turns out that there is one isotope or one form of uranium called uranium-235, which is very rare. It's only 7 atoms out of every 1,000 atoms of uranium that are called uranium-235. So this is a relatively rare form of uranium found in nature, and it's the stuff that you can make an atomic bomb out of uranium-235. That's what the Hiroshima bomb was made from. In fact, it was made from uranium-235. So for that reason, it's called a uranium bomb. However, they discovered quite early on that the way you get energy from uranium-235 is by splitting the atoms. And when you split the atoms, you get a lot of energy being released, and you also get hundreds of different radioactive byproducts, which are the broken pieces of the uranium atoms. That's why when a bomb explodes, when an atomic bomb explodes, there's literally hundreds of different radioactive materials which were created at the moment the bomb exploded. And these are called the fission products, and they are the broken pieces of the uranium atoms, and they're very radioactive, and they're very dangerous to living things. So that's where the bomb fallout comes from,
mm-hmm.
and that's also where the high-level radioactive waste from a nuclear reactor comes from. It's the same stuff.
Ah.
The only difference is that in a bomb, it's scattered in the air. In a reactor, it's kept in the fuel. Now, what they discovered early on is that there is this other type of uranium called uranium-238. Now, uranium-238 is no good for a bomb. You can't make a bomb from it. In fact, you can't even make a bomb from naturally occurring uranium because there's too much U-238. The uranium-238 sort of gets in the way. But when you put uranium into a reactor, into a nuclear reactor, you can get a slow chain reaction going on inside the reactor, which is quite fierce, as a matter of fact, by human standards, but which is not a bomb. And through this slow fission process, which is achieved by use of a moderator, you can split those uranium atoms and boil water and generate electricity, but something else happens at the same time. Some of the uranium-238 atoms absorb a neutron and get turned into uranium-239 atoms. Now, those uranium-239 atoms rapidly change into a brand new substance called plutonium-239. And so what's happening is that there's two things going on. Inside the reactor, you've got both types of uranium atoms there. The U-235 atoms are splitting and releasing energy, but meanwhile, the U-238 atoms are changing into plutonium. Now, the thing about plutonium is that it is a very powerful nuclear explosive, much more powerful than the U-235 itself. And so now it has become the nuclear explosive of choice for all. Most of the nuclear weapons in the world today are powered, they're triggered with plutonium. Plutonium is the principal, primary nuclear explosive in all the warheads. When they talk about dismantling warheads, you know, they've already dismantled thousands of warheads. When they dismantle these warheads, they take out the plutonium part of it. And once that plutonium part is removed, those warheads are useless. They're no longer possible. They're no longer capable of exploding.
Mm.
So the plutonium is the key ingredient there. And that's produced by every single nuclear reactor in the world. There's no nuclear reactor that doesn't produce plutonium as a byproduct. Now, the nuclear industry, when talking about a renaissance, you know, there's all this talk right now about a renaissance,
yes,
about maybe using nuclear power to combat global warming,
yes,
which is unfortunately not even possible to really solve the global warming problem with nuclear power. But nevertheless, it's a selling point for people who want to sell the reactors. And of course, it's quite attractive to many people for completely other reasons. But at any rate, when they run these reactors, they if they start building tens of thousands of nuclear reactors, which they would like to do, they're going to run out of uranium. And in order to keep those reactors fueled, they're going to have to stop using uranium as a fuel and start using plutonium as a fuel instead. So what they're proposing to do is to set up international centers where they will reprocess this irradiated nuclear fuel, which contains the plutonium, and they'll separate the plutonium and the uranium out of the waste material and reuse that as fuel for reactors. The reason why this is so dangerous is that, unlike uranium itself, you see, natural uranium in fuel cannot be used for a bomb directly. It has to be enriched, and that's very difficult to do. It's very time-consuming, it takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of time. And there's no way that that a criminal organization would have the time or the resources to do that. But when you have plutonium fuel, it's completely different. You can separate that plutonium out chemically, and you can use it directly in a bomb. Hmm. And so it makes the material for nuclear weapons much more available.
So this renaissance would lead to recycling of the plutonium in power plants.
And that's very dangerous.
I see. And are there dangers associated with it besides the proliferation of plutonium?
The biggest danger is the proliferation of making plutonium readily available,
right,
in the world at large. But there's also other dangers, and that is, and this is something that's hard for people to understand, but when you take uranium, let's suppose that you would imagine having on your desk in front of you a uranium fuel bundle, which is, in the case of a CANDU reactor, a Canadian reactor, these fuel bundles are about the size of a large fireplace log.
Hmm.
So you imagine a fireplace log in front of you, all metallic and gleaming, right, because it's covered in this metal called zirconium. And inside those zirconium tubes are the uranium pellets. Well, uranium does not give off very much penetrating radiation, so you could actually look at this fuel bundle and you could handle it. I would advise that you wear gloves, and I would advise that you don't keep it there all the time, but you could handle it for a period of 15 minutes or so, And you wouldn't be getting any particularly alarming dose of radiation from that. However, you put that fuel bundle into a nuclear reactor and use it to generate electricity, and when it comes out, the other end, it looks exactly the same as it did when it went in. But now, it will kill you in less than 20 seconds at a distance of 1 meter.
Hmm.
And the reason why is because it is now giving off very intense penetrating radiation, which is deadly. And how come that's happening? Well, it's because of those fission products I mentioned. These are hundreds of different broken pieces of uranium atoms, and they have all different names. And I call these, they're basically, I call them different shapes of the uranium atom because they're all broken pieces of uranium atoms. And some of them are called strontium-90, and some of them are called cesium-137, and some of them are called iodine-131, and krypton-85, and ruthenium-99, and technetium-99. All of these substances are created through the splitting of the uranium atom. And they're millions of times more radioactive than the uranium that you started with. These are so radioactive that if you... Let's take a nuclear reactor, for example. Suppose a nuclear reactor is churning out electricity by boiling water through the splitting of the atoms, okay? If you shut the reactor down right now, let's say we just shut it down, we turn off the nuclear reaction completely, which you can do, you cannot shut off the radioactivity. The radioactivity persists. It continues even after the reactor is shut down. In fact, it persists for millions of years after the reactor is shut down. Well, the trouble is that radioactivity in the core of the reactor is so intense that unless it is cooled by high-pressure pumps circulating water through the core of the reactor itself will melt at a temperature of over 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's called a meltdown. Now, the reason it's called a meltdown is because the temperature at which the fuel melts is thousands of degrees higher than the temperature at which steel melts, so that it just melts its way through everything like butter. And what happens at that point is that all these radioactive gases and vapors are released into the atmosphere of the reactor building, and if the reactor building fails, then they're released into the environment. So then you have a nuclear catastrophe such as Chernobyl. That's what happened at Chernobyl.
I see.
What happened at Chernobyl is they had a loss of cooling followed by an explosion, followed by a fire, and that lofted all this radioactive junk into the air. So this is the big problem with nuclear reactors, is that besides producing plutonium for bombs, they're also deadly, you might say deadly warehouses of nuclear poisons. Now, if you had a conventional war such as World War II, taking place in a situation where there were nuclear reactors planted in different cities, those reactors would undoubtedly be targeted with bombs and with sabotage during warfare. And as a result, you'd have large areas of land that would be uninhabitable for generations following the war because of the radioactive contamination from the reactors. So these machines are not just machines for producing electricity. They also mass-produce these fission products along with the plutonium. And those fission products remain deadly to all living things for very long periods of time. In fact, when the fuel is removed from the reactor, it has to be cooled underwater, circulating water, in what are called spent fuel bays, for at least 7 to 10 years before it can be safely taken out and stored in dry storage. And that's because of the heat.
And what kind of time period are you talking about these things have to be safeguarded?
Well, they have to be safeguarded basically forever. That's why they talk about this idea of geological storage, but the trouble is that they can't bury this stuff underground for at least 20 or 30 years because underground there's no place for the heat to go. And you would have a heat buildup underground, which could lead to an eruption of, let's say, a radioactive geyser of steam that's generated by the heat of the buried waste. So in order to bury this waste at all, you have to wait 20 or 30 years before it's cooled off. But in the meantime, it's right at the surface and is a perpetual threat to the surrounding populations. And not just the surrounding populations, but as we saw in Chernobyl, this stuff can spread across continents. Even today, many people don't realize that even today, there are hundreds of farms in northern England and northern Wales which cannot sell their sheep meat, their sheep for human consumption, because of radioactive contamination from the Chernobyl accident 20 years ago, over 20 years ago.
I know that I live in Warren, Vermont, and Montpelier, I think, was recorded the highest dose of fallout
in North America
from Chernobyl, Montpelier, Vermont, in a rainstorm.
Really?
In a rainstorm that happened several days after the meltdown.
Right. Well, that's the stuff is. That's the problem, is that, you know, one has to ask the question, and this is where the previous discussion that we had comes into play. The previous discussion being about, you know, what kind of a planet are we hoping to have? Why would you want to promote a technology which mass produces deadly poisons? I think that the sensible thing to do would be to phase out technologies that mass produce deadly poisons. And, for example, here in Quebec, we had a bad fire at a community called Saint-Basile-le-Grand. It was a fire involving a warehouse where they were storing PCBs. And the result is there was thick, toxic black smoke that came rolling off this warehouse, which caught fire. Mm. And, of course, the firemen were contaminated when they tried to fight the blaze. Well, as a result of that incident, Quebec decided that they would no more ever use PCBs. And so we have phased out completely the use of PCBs. Well, I think that we should think about that in terms of other technologies, and certainly nuclear is high on the list there, because nuclear is the only technology that actually creates new radioactive elements. There's no other technology on Earth that creates new radioactive elements, and each one of these different elements behaves in a different way. For example, one of these substances is called iodine-131. Now, when you have a nuclear accident, a lot of iodine-131 comes off. Well, it so happens that this is a man-made substance. It doesn't exist in nature. It accumulates on the grass. The cows eat the grass, and it gets concentrated in their milk. And then children drink the milk, and it gets concentrated in their thyroid glands. And in the thyroid gland, it can cause all kinds of developmental abnormalities, such including mental retardation, stunting of growth, not to mention thyroid cancer. Now, in Belarus, adjacent to Ukraine, where the Chernobyl accident happened, there have been over 5,000 children who have had their thyroid glands surgically removed because of contamination from the Chernobyl accident. So, I mean, you know, why do we want to have a technology that spreads these kinds of materials around? That's only one material. Other materials also, they have their own individual properties, their own individual characteristics. Cesium-137 behaves like potassium. And when it gets into the food chain, potassium basically goes to the blood and to, therefore, all the soft organs. And that's why the meat is contaminated in northern England. Hmm. It's because of cesium-137, basically, which goes into the meat, which goes into the muscle tissues. So each one of these radioactive substances, some of these radioactive substances are bone seekers, like strontium-90. It goes to the bone, and there it can cause bone cancer, and it can cause leukemia and various blood diseases, and it can also damage the immune system and therefore make you more vulnerable to infectious diseases. So all of these things are inimical to the functioning of healthy biological systems.
So it creates these toxins, radioactive toxins, that the body mistakes for actual nutrients.
Exactly. Because the body has no, our evolutionary development over 4 billion years has not had to deal with these materials, and consequently our bodies have no evolutionary biological mechanisms for recognizing them as being any different from the normal substances that we get in our food. So the body mistakes the strontium-90 for healthy calcium and puts the calcium where calcium normally goes, which is in the bones, the teeth, and mother's milk.
Mm.
And that's where the strontium-90 goes.
Professor Gordon Edwards, we only have about 5 minutes left, and we have a situation here in Vermont where Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant in southern Vermont is coming up for relicensing. And if the Vermont legislature does not actively relicense them, they will have to close. So there's a debate going on here. And many times in the paper you read that we need the nuclear power because there are no alternatives. And also they say that there is no danger from nuclear power because it's no different. The radiation from the nuclear power plant is no different than the background radiation you'd get from a interstate excavation where they excavate to build our interstate system. And it sounds like what you're saying is that they produce toxins not known to man before. That's not the same as background uranium pollution at all. And also, are you saying that nuclear power plants aren't self-contained, that they do leak?
Well, they do leak, yes. They do leak. They give off, in particular, certain materials. Now, not all of these materials are non-existent in nature. Iodine-131 doesn't exist in nature. Cesium-137 doesn't exist in nature prior to the development of atomic fission. However, there are other substances like tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen. Now, this does exist in nature, has existed for billions of years, in fact. It's produced in the upper atmosphere by cosmic radiation. However, in nature, if you look at natural water systems, you would get about 2 or 3 becquerels per liter. A becquerel means one atomic disintegration is occurring every second. So in a normal liter of water, you would have 2 or 3 disintegrations per second of tritium. Now here in Canada, we have plants which mass produce tritium and release trillions of becquerels into the atmosphere all the time. And the result is that the levels of tritium, radioactive hydrogen, in the Great Lakes is measurably increasing from year to year. You can measure the increase from one year to the next. And this is all the result of nuclear power reactors, mostly on the Canadian side, I might add. However, the American reactors also give off tritium. In fact, I know that Vermont Yankee gives off a lot of tritium. And they also give off something called carbon-14. Now, although these are naturally occurring as well, they don't exist in nature in anything like the quantities in which they are produced in the nuclear reactors or anything like the quantities which are released from the nuclear reactors. So I think it's really misinformation, and it's something that scientists, I think, have a responsibility, independent scientists who are not working for Vermont Yankee, have a responsibility to try and explain that this is not the whole truth. Now, recently there were, if I have time, I could mention the German experience, because I think this is very useful.
Yeah, you have
a couple of minutes?
You have 3 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes. Okay, point number one. Germany decided about 10 years ago to phase out of nuclear power. They've already shut down 2 reactors, and they're in the process of shutting down the third one out of 17 reactors. And in the process of that, in less than 8 years, they built 22,000 megawatts of wind power. Now, 22,000 megawatts is more than the entire Canadian nuclear industry of 22 nuclear reactors. So they can do that in 8 years. You couldn't even build 22,000 megawatts of nuclear in 8 years. It wouldn't be possible. So that's point number one. Point number two, and by the way, they've also given approval for 24,000 more megawatts of wind power. Point number two is they did a study commissioned by the government of Germany, the largest study ever done, of the health of people living in the vicinity of nuclear reactors in Germany. And this was a huge study involving millions of people. And they found a significant increase in leukemia among children under 5 years of age living close to these reactors, living within 5 or 10 kilometers of the reactors. Now, this study has been looked at very closely, and it seems to be very well done and very well, the conclusions are inescapable. However, nobody understands the mechanism by which these children are getting leukemia. The nuclear industry people say it's not possible that this is caused by radiation because these reactors don't give off anything like the necessary amounts of radiation to cause that much cancer. However, a recent study published in a refereed journal from a British scientist named Ian Fairley has pointed out that in order for them to get cancer under 5 years of age, they must have been irradiated when they were still in the womb. In other words, just developing in the womb as embryos. And embryos are much more sensitive to radiation damage than adults or even young children are. So it could be that the tritium that is given off from these plants and the carbon-14 given off by these plants, which is known to cross the placenta and go into the embryo, that these could be the cause of this rash of childhood leukemias in children under 5. But the point is, to try and deny that this is a problem is really, I would say, it's not the China syndrome, it's the ostrich syndrome. Put your head in the sand and pretend it's not there.
All right. Well, Professor Gordon Edwards, thanks so much for being on today. And I'm sorry about the technical problems in the beginning, but you imparted a lot of useful information. And I'd like to talk to you again sometime about some of the other aspects.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
If you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.